Accession number 14974, Paul Armstrong, reel 25.
Mr. P. Armstrong, reel 25. You wanted to describe another event, Mr. Armstrong.
Yes. It was rather remiss of me, but when we advanced up the coast after the Boulogne and Calais had been taken, one of the big jobs that were concerning the British Army were the fact that the V1, that is what was commonly known as the Doodlebug sites, there were still some in the area to the interland of from Calais and Boulogne. So we were sent to those. Of course, by the time we arrived there, the personnel had been captured and evacuated. But it was very interesting to see one could reach a site and yet not appreciate what it was. The ramp was earth, which had been banked up and which had literally been turfed over so that it couldn't be seen from literally 200 or 300 yards. And the site of the men's, the garrison you can call it, accommodation was underground immediately to the rear, as was the housing for the bombs, which were just wheeled up on railways, miniature railways, assembled and straight onto the it was a little railway line that led up to the one. Again, the camouflage must have been removed from it each time it was going to be fired. The small pilotless bombs were assembled in it. The local Frenchman told them it was incredible how fast they wheeled them out, put them together, whistled them off, and then disappeared back into the bunker, so that there was no signs for the Air Force, who were searching daily and were bombing all around, even on spec. But it was surprising how many hadn't been found during these operations. And all we had to do was literally to make sure that they couldn't be moved again. We blew in the tunnels and the accommodation and some of the equipment. But it was extremely interesting to see the sort of things that had been dropping on us in the southeast of England, because, as I said earlier, it was my unit that went to search for one of these V1 bombs. When we found one, we took our place back in the invasion of Europe, and it merely, I don't think it cost us more than a couple of days on our position in the invasion.
They were quite an interesting thing to see. Were they large and complex, the site itself, although it was camouflaged?
No, it was really beautifully done. It's easy to dig in that area of Calais and the hinterland, and so of course they tunnelled it out pretty early on, before the V1 bombs were even ready. And they had munition dumps there for the guns, the cross-channel guns, so that they were preparing as far back as 1941. And so, of course, they were merely extended it. Where the soil came from to make the earthworks, because you can picture a ramp rising to a height of about 30 feet, and starting from nothing, you can imagine the angle. And this was so that it was aimed so that it would theoretically hit London. And this then was, I say, camouflaged so wonderfully, because they had time, which we never had. Our camouflage was, I'm afraid, very, very sketchy because it had to be improvised on the spot. This had been planned, and planned by experts who'd been at it for many years.
You mentioned that you were moving towards Antwerp and the ground had been inundated and you were moving around it.
Oh, that was because it was decided that it was the garrison, the German garrison of that area around Antwerp and, the surrounding land. The Germans must have clearly realised that we would have to seize a port very, very quickly, which could be used for heavy equipment as well as the ports we've got so far. So the Canadians, who we'd been supporting up till that time, were having a pretty hard time, and it was decided to send a heavy bomber attack to breach the dams, the dikes. And when this was done, there was, of course, an enormous area was flooded. It doesn't need a lot of damage to a dike to cause dreadful inundations. And this had happened. So, of course, while it cleared off a lot of the Germans who couldn't occupy the positions they were in, some of the more effective built-up defensive positions were still intact. So the Canadians had the unfortunate experience of having to attack through water or waterlogged country. We did go up to help them then, and it was towards then that we more or less finished our job with the Canadians, because they were anxious to get this Antwerp cleared and to get on, and they went surrounded that area. You probably have read about it many times, but our jobs were very, very, how shall I put it, pedestrian. There was nothing warlike about it. It was purely and simply engineering support. And we did what we could. It was extremely uncomfortable. It was bloody wet for quite a long time, and at that time it was beginning to get to the end of the it was early on when it was still pretty cold and pretty miserable, and everybody had a rather unpleasant time. However,
what kind of jobs were you doing?
We were making roads passable. We were trying to were reinforcing bridges that had been put across. The field engineers, of course, do bridges just sufficient to get the forward troops through, and then they are moving on. They are very, very much to the front. So ours was quite a tailback job, and purely and simply reinforcing and supporting anything that was required. You see, a unit such as ours had a lot of very, very useful equipment, which obviously very rarely was properly appreciated. And many times we were sitting, we had generator wagons, we had bulldozers, you name it, we had the equipment, and yet we were frequently sitting thinking, why can't we get on? Why can't we do this? But this is the unfortunate thing about a British unit being seconded to help a Canadian unit. They, of course, were relying on their own people, and I suppose the British Army didn't want us to be too far away from their control, because they were feeding us and supplying in the various things to enable us to move. Likewise, we had a position to which we would eventually, and did eventually take in the advance through Germany.
So So you said that you left the Canadians before they got involved in Antwerp.
Oh no, no, they wiped Antwerp up then, and we reverted to Second British Army 8 Corps, which what was where we should have been.
What date would this be?
Between March and April, I wouldn't like to say. I would think it was it would be getting in towards April.
1945?
Oh yes, yes, we're still in 45.
Where did you go next?
Well, this is the time when it was very, very fluid. And so I can't even recollect, because one was such a short time in the various places. So I was still doing my job of recce officer for the unit, but taking my instructions from the chief engineer. And so, of course, we were told where to go and where we would fit in. And what the usual practice was to try and put us into barracks that had been, or properties that had been occupied by the German army. We had one unfortunate occurrence where the billets we'd been allotted to had previously been occupied by some Algerians. Whether they were soldiers, whether they were displaced persons, what they were, I don't know. The local people said when we shot out of it, because we went in, and I'm fortunate in that livestock doesn't attack me, but my sergeant came out the other side and his head was swollen to almost double the size, even in the question of going through the billets. It was so dreadful. Was incredible, and the stench was frightful. So we said we wouldn't take it over, and we didn't get much sympathy. So someone spilt a can of petrol as they were moving through, and someone dropped a cigarette, and it went up in flames. So there was no need for us to bother anymore. They found us another billet further on. But of course, those poor people all had to be defumigated. Most unfortunate. Well, we went through, we went via the Nijmegen Bridge actually to bring our heavy equipment over, and we camped near a place called Enschede, which isn't a big town, but we didn't camp in the town. We camped on this, we're pretty well on the border now. And we moved, various places, Mönchengladbach, those sort of places we were going through, because we were being pushed from here to there, as I say, doing reinforcement work, bolstering bridges, doubling them up. These Bailey bridges are such wonderful things that you could follow on, literally carry on where they'd left off. And from a bridge that would only take, say, 3 tons, you could make it up to 12, 20 ton in very little space of time. It was a wonderful thing, a wonderful bridge. I had the privilege of meeting Sir Donald, well, he was Don Bailey then, and he was a civil servant. And when I met him, he was in a sports jacket and a pair of old flannels.
I think we've got this already on the tape.
Ah. So you can see I was very, very interested on how it was working.
You'll be moving through Holland at this point.
Yes.
And how were the Dutch receiving you?
Oh, calamitous. The poor Dutch. People talk about what France suffered and what Belgium suffered. No country that I went through suffered like Holland. The first little town we went into, and it was just a staging post. We weren't even going to spend the night there that I recollect. We probably just put bivouacs up. But wherever the British Army are, they have the evening meal and the swill tubs are put out. And there's about, you can imagine, there'll be about 10 swill tubs. When I say swill tubs, clean bins. And I was walking round, I probably was orderly officer that day, I wouldn't like to say, but I was walking round, and to my astonishment, I saw 10 little bums in the air. And when I went up, there was 10 little Dutch children, literally inside, seizing the swill that had been thrown out, because the British Army is pretty wasteful in food. And there was more and more children running up to take their part in this manna to them, literally manna. And from then on, while we were in Holland, we never threw anything out until the locals had taken what they wanted, and which was practically everything. The Dutch men and women I spoke to told us that they were reduced to living on the bulbs of the flowers that they'd grown. It was truly frightful. You can understand people like ourselves being short, but it was appalling to see the state of these poor little children. It shocked our men. They'd been a little bit casual about it until then, but they were horrified to see what they did see.
Did you come across any points where an atrocity had taken place?
No. The immediate cleaning out had taken place before, as soon as the infantry had gone through, and before any clearing up was done by the British Army, or the Canadian Army, as the case may be, the local people had taken into their own hands. I don't know whether I mentioned the place at Poix in France that we saw, where there was two collaborators.
Well, have that.
This had happened up in all the way up, as what we were moving through Belgium and Holland. The locals had taken care of them, and there was little evidence left.
Did you come across any Germans?
At that time?
Prisoners of war.
Oh, they were moved very, very quickly. The prisoners of war were sent straight back into camps very, very quickly. But we had no handle in that. It was done by other units in the army. We were engineers, and we were supposed not to interfere with other sort of duties. There were a lot of displaced persons milling about, and they were of every nationality, probably some Germans amongst them, because the first thing they did was to get rid of a uniform, whatever country, whatever army they belonged to. There were Germans, there were Poles, there were Russians, there were Frenchmen. All these DPs were milling about desperately looking for food, the same as the local people were. So, of course, there was a little bit of, well, there's a lot of animosity between them. And the locals tried to drive them away, naturally, because they would steal anything, they would burn anything. They were pretty desperate, naturally, and they were pretty ugly customers. Again, we didn't bother with them. They kept out of our way, and away we went.
Where did you go to next, Mr. Armstrong?
Well, we moved up in stages to Bremen, which we bypassed, of course. And on towards Osnabrück, and very interesting, everyone could tell when we're in Germany, because more or less every house or every second house had a white flag, a white blanket, a white sheet, a white whatever hanging outside. I must say, that they had received the same punishment to their houses as the French, well, not quite so much the French, but the Belgians and the Dutch had received on the way up. But then, when you came towards Bremen, which unfortunately we didn't have a job, there were other engineer units working on it, but they were literally, I'm not going to say obliterated, but they were devastated. The bombing was really fantastic. And it speaks a lot for the ability of the Germans to keep a war going in the way they did amid such devastation. I was astonished.
What attitude did the German civilians have that you were seeing or coming into contact with?
There weren't so many men of military age, so that it was mainly women or old people or children. The children, like children all over, were not bothered about us being British. As long as we weren't Russians, they were quite happy. But the women just accepted it as we went past. In fact, in certain places, people were waving to us as you went past. The German's a strange person, very strange. When he's on top, he's very, very arrogant. When he's down, he's very servile. And I don't think the Germans will ever change. That's my opinion of the whole German race. And later on, I'll tell you why I think this.
What was the food situation then? Were they begging in a pretty bad way?
The Germans didn't actually beg from us. I must say that. And the food situation was poor. In fact, later on, when we got up to our eventual destination in Schleswig-Holstein, Montgomery issued an instruction that no one had to take food from the Germans. And at first, that even included vegetables. And we were pretty short of vegetables, and it was a bit galling to see masses of vegetables growing and forbidden to, forbidden to use them. Sometimes, somehow, when our back was turned, they appeared in the rations.
Were you still doing these follow-up jobs that you were mentioning?
Yes, we all the way. That's one thing, I must be honest with you. I thought that the scale of the advance was so remarkably well organized. I thought we would have been, I suppose, also just think you're going to have an unemployed period when you'd be able to relax. We weren't. We weren't able to relax at all. We were moving up all the time. And this is how I'm not able to remember our route. I possibly could, if I'd been back into Germany, I possibly could have followed it. But I would have difficulty in thinking back now, because it is so fluid. You can picture us moving forward. You can picture the DPs milling about. You can picture people trying to get back into their homes, trying to rebuild. It was literally movement all the time. This is movement. Go, go, go. This was it. They were on the move now, and we were pushing forward as hard as we could. And literally, we were running up to V-Day. I can't even remember where I was when it was V-Day. We just stopped and then moved on. I can't even remember having a party. It's gone. The anxiety was to get going. Why, you ask? The main reason, I think, with hindsight, was that the Prime Minister and his staff were very anxious to get as much of Germany as possible before the Russians took it. And so, of course, they were aiming at nipping off not only Schleswig-Holstein, but Holland, Denmark, Norway, and you can see why. I see it now, but at the time we couldn't quite fathom why we had to be moving with such speed. There was no such talk of consolidation or settling or doing anything. You just, I didn't tell you how long I lived in my clothes at that time. It was very difficult to get any sort of a change.
Had all German opposition stopped? Had it ceased by now? You weren't getting shelling or anything?
At this time, none. German opposition had stopped. There was talk of German werewolves about. Personally, I didn't think a lot of that. I thought there might be German thieves, but I didn't see any likelihood of this happening.
What was a werewolf?
Oh, the werewolves were supposed to be parties that Hitler had organised to lurk about and fall onto Allied troops and murder them or deal with them as much as they could. It was one of Hitler's ideas, which was purely an idea. He wanted to do as much destruction as possible. He wanted to pull Germany down as well as every other country down, so he didn't care how Germany suffered at that time.
You can't recall then your excitement, exultation when the war, actually the war news came through that it was finished on such and such a date, such and such a time. That hasn't registered with you?
It registered in that we knew they were on the run. They were moving, they were retreating very, very quickly then. And so, of course, we were being driven to the follow-up. VE Day to us meant, I suppose, that there wouldn't be armed opposition, although up in the northern parts of Germany, the troops hadn't surrendered. It was just the main armies where, for instance, this was in Lüneburg, where Montgomery took the surrender. But at that time, no, I'm sorry, we didn't have the opportunity of stopping and enjoying VE Day. We kept on moving. We stopped that day, we had drank bottles and said thank God for that, and then we moved on.
In those last weeks and days leading up to the end, were you coming across mines and booby traps?
Oh yes, not a lot. You see, what was happening, the Germans were retreating so quickly that they hadn't time to do the sort of camouflage that they had done coming up through France and into Belgium. Even into Belgium the mines were nothing like as carefully camouflaged, and so what they frequently did was just to lay them on a road to deny it to advancing armour, and the armour had to go around and delayed them and turned them into areas where the Germans could have a crack at them. There were lots of rearguard actions all the time, but that cleared. It was interesting. It was just like a Hoover movie along. The armoured people, the infantry went on. You see, at that time, there was great rivalry. The guards armoured were determined to be in first, and they were driving on. And, of course, all the other armoured troops thought, to you, and they were all pushing as hard as they could, So, of course, we were kept on the move because we had to be there to reinforce. You see, you got to, for instance, a simple bridge where it would take, as I said earlier, probably 3 tons, and the heavy stuff was waiting to go over. And the heavy stuff, of course, included the petrol convoys, which were pretty heavy and constant. So one had that sort. The jobs were absolutely unending. But it was fun. Don't get me wrong. And we were built up and enjoying it, but we knew we couldn't stop. Once an army's winning and on the move, you've got to keep the impetus going if you're to get anywhere. Once you slow down and stop, as frequently it happened in the past, it gave them time to the German rearguard actions were excellent, but there weren't enough of them to withstand the volume. All they could do was check hours, day, 2 days, but after that the force couldn't be stopped. It moved too fast. And don't forget, possibly what I haven't mentioned so far, what I haven't emphasized as I should have done, the Air Force had almost full control of the skies, and that had it so long we expected it. That's why we got such a shock when Rundstedt did his counterattack when we were down in Calais.